welcome to the Film Fans Podcast, the podcast from movie fans for movie fans. I'm your host, Ryan Dunleavy. That is my co-host, Rob Dunham.
Howdy.
It was a very enthusiastic howdy from Rob there. Good job. It's all good. It's late. We're recording late. It's fine. We'll bring the heat, bring the energy. We are going to, of course, talk about the box office and the movie that came out of nowhere to captivate everyone's imagination and inspire a million takes, some of them not good, some of them pretty accurate. And we will discuss that. We'll discuss the movie's opening this weekend. And as we promised last week, we are going to do a discussion on the use of color. So our use of color, we've hit on this a few times in various different avenues, but we're going to tackle it directly, and we assigned each other colors. So Rob was assigned to explore the use of green in color, and I explored the use of red. So it'd be fun to see what we came up with on those color usages in movies. And of course, we will wrap up with our watch list, movies we've watched over the last week. All right, Rob, you ready?
Let's do it.
So, Rob, if I were to tell you there was a movie whose budget was under $10 million going up against Star Wars, the latest Star Wars movie, in its second week in the box office, what do you think the odds are of said movie completely annihilating Star Wars at the box office?
It would have to be pretty low.
Yeah. Well, that is precisely what happened, folks. Surprise movie of the year, Back Rooms, came in number one at the box office. The A24 release that we talked about a little bit last week, we're going to talk about more this week, came in number one at the box office in a total of $81.4 million. In its opening week in the box office. Now, this comes on only being in 3,442 theaters, which means it made an average of $23,600 per cinema. And as we'll get down to some of the other ones, nothing else in the box office even did $10,000 per theater.
Just anecdotally, we're going to get there, but the breadwinner, the Nate Margazzi movie, on its opening night, made less than $900 a theater, just for comparison's sake.
However, the breadwinner did rally a little bit.
Yeah.
So, number two was Obsession, another horror-related film. $27.3 million in its third week in the box office. This one actually gained money in its third week. Yeah, so it went up crazy. 14% from week two to week three. Partially that could be due to it gained 126 theaters, which always helps. It has done $105.7 million in 3 weeks. Now, Star Wars, The Mandalorian and Grogu, in week number two, did $24 million. That is a 70% drop off from week one to week two.
That's rough.
Oof. $136.8 million after 2 weeks for the first new Star Wars movie in, what, 7 years? Ooh. Yeah, that's rough. That's rough out there, folks. Yeah, not good. Number four this week was Michael, dropping down from number three last week. It did $11.8 million in its sixth week in the box office, $340 million total for that one in 6 weeks. And coming in number five, The Breadwinner, $7.3 million in its debut in the box office. So after a little bit of a rocky start, $7.3 million for an indie kind of comedy is not a terrible result. Probably would they would like more? Sure.
That's not, yeah, true. I would say like projections just a couple weeks ago said they were hoping for 12 to 15.
Yeah.
Opening. So not great when you only make about half of what they were hoping you would make.
Yeah. Now we'll see. Maybe it's one of those that people will get around to and have a little bit of legs, but probably going to come in a little bit under projections.
Also, a very strange thing this movie did, which I'm not sure why, other than I guess they cared more about the amount of people seeing the movie, is I'm pretty sure, like, in every cinema, there was a special price, like basically matinee pricing for this movie for every showing called the Nate Rate. Like, it was a whole thing they did, like a whole viral campaign they did. So I don't know what to make of that, because it probably means more people saw it than would not have seen it, but it also means like they factor that in to figure out how much money you made. So it made less than, the question is, did it make less than it would have made if it was priced at full price?
That is an interesting question. I'm sure there is marketing people somewhere figuring that out right now.
It's just, it was very surprising to me because I'd never actually seen that for movie before. That, like, it was advertised on Regal's website. Every showing is that name pricing.
Yeah,
It's very interesting.
that is really interesting. It's a unique take on a campaign to try and get people to see your movie. I mean, we've seen those campaigns where they pre-sell a bunch of tickets and they get advocacy groups to like purchase a bunch of tickets as a way to boost initial sales to drive up things on opening weekend. But I've never seen that one. So
Yeah.
yeah, not bad. We'll see how that one does. So now we come to, what do you want to tackle first? Do you want to tackle the nosedive Star Wars took, or do we want to tackle Back Rooms? Because in some ways, they are an interesting juxtaposition.
I mean, I feel like we did talk about how underwhelming the first week of the Star Wars movie was.
Yeah.
So for it to drop that precipitously is disastrous. And for the same reasons you said it wasn't a surprise why it didn't do great to begin with, I think they're the exact same reasons why it dropped so much, because I think most of the people who wanted to see the movie saw it opening weekend.
Yep. And I don't
There's just not a rabid fan base for this
Yeah.
character. Like, it's a decent TV show, and I think that's about it, you know?
It's always this interesting phenomenon where this used to be a bigger deal. It's not quite the same as it used to be, but the idea of like you have a big time television star and then they want to cross over into movies. And for whatever reason, quite a few of them don't quite make it or can't quite make that transition and end up never really becoming what they were on TV. And I think just because the medium is different, the requirements are different, and it's a whole different thing. I think there's something to say here. Yes, The Mandalorian was a popular TV show on Disney Plus, but that might just mean that people were okay with watching it on their TV. It was
Yeah.
something that sparked so much lore that everyone needed to go see it in the theater. And so I think it really did fail to attract an audience, a crossover audience into the movie realm. And that IP is just gonna, it's just not gonna be part of the Star Wars lore that's going to draw people out and really get people excited about the direction of the franchise.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that that's becoming less of a huge barrier for people to cross over, just because the quality of television is getting better and better. It's getting more cinematic. So you're seeing, like, with the show Fargo, like Billy Bob Thornton and Martin Freeman, Jon Hamm, like all these people starring in that show. Ewan McGregor was the star of the season of that show. So you're seeing, like, more and more, especially like the marquee big name shows, people are going back and forth between things. I think COVID was a big reason for that, because they
Yeah.
went to the place where they could work, and like a medium that they could work in. And I think that that's kind of leveled the playing field a little bit.
I
But
think
I
at the
do
same
think
time, though.
Pedro, yeah, I
Yeah.
do think Pedro is like definitely more of a TV guy than a movie guy. I mean, he was. I thought he was pretty good in the Fantastic Four movie.
See, I think In general, the most of the guys you mentioned were already TV stars and came down to, or already movie stars and came down the telephone. I think going that direction is much, much easier. And now I think the difference with The Mandalorian is, I would say Pedro Pascal, for some reason, is popular in movies, but I don't think The Mandalorian really showcases Pedro Pascal as it was, because half of Mandalorian's lore is that he never takes his helmet off. And his generally stoic character doesn't lend itself to being like, yeah, Pedro Pascal, I want to go see him. You could put somebody else in there and the differences would not be that dramatic. I don't know. I mean, we'll see. Maybe it just could be the Disney of it all. And similar to the way DC can't get their junk together to make a decent run at their comics, then maybe Disney, Star Wars under Disney is having similar issues. We'll see. Now let's get to back rooms a little bit. So this is fascinating on so many different levels. And I don't know that I've seen this path, but I think you're getting more, starting to get more and more of this. The beginning of back rooms was a photo posted, I think, was it on Reddit or 4chan or some one of those started out with just a photo of some empty rooms in an office before it was renovated, which then spawned a bunch of online discourse, which then turned into a YouTube series that became wildly popular. A24 then came calling and gave that director of the YouTube series the opportunity to direct the full movie release of it. And $81.4 million later, people noticed.
Yeah, I mean, this is like a cultural phenomenon because the pre-sales were very strong for this movie because people were coming because of the stories online and the video series online. I didn't, to be honest, I didn't know anything about either of those because I just was not connected to it. I saw a trailer and I thought, that looks cool. I don't want to see anything more about it because that looks cool and I want to see the movie. So I watched a trailer for this movie in the theater. Didn't watch or read anything else about the movie before going into it, other than knowing like the origin of it. And am I the only one of us who has seen this?
What was that?
Am I the only one of us who have seen this movie?
Yeah, I have not seen
Okay.
it yet.
So
But I haven't seen it
one
yet.
thing I will say about it, I also think it's done very well because it is a well-made movie. Like this movie is the eye the director has in this movie, like someone making their movie debut has no business having as good of an eye. Like there's some shots in this movie and some framing and just storytelling through the visual medium that's like top notch. So I think there's a combination of people being like super excited about it. Word of mouth on this movie spread like super fast, and I think it's because of its origin. I think it's because it started as an internet thing that it probably like the good news of it propagated all throughout the internet, and drove more people to it. And so that's why like it completely took people by surprise by how much money it made. The only the most recent thing I can think of is like the Barbie Oppenheimer thing, where there's like that combination that people were not expecting to like just explode, and people were not expecting this to explode in this way either. You don't make 8 times your budget opening weekend on a movie. Like it's crazy. Like I was shocked when I went to get tickets for this movie on Saturday of opening weekend, and I was having to go to like the 9:30 and 10 o'clock shows just to find 2 seats in a decent spot together. So like when I see that happening in my local theater, that usually tends to indicate a trend. Very rarely do you see like a movie just do super well in one location. Like if it's doing really well where you're at, it's probably doing really well most of the country. So to see that there was that much demand, I was like, oh boy, this thing is gonna make a lot of money. Like because there are a lot of people flocking to this thing.
Yeah, for sure. And it's interesting because of its origin standpoint. The question is did A24 just happen to cast lightning in a bottle? Was it the perfect thing, the perfect piece of like internet IP, the perfect director who was capable, who had much more capabilities than what he'd been given? And did they just happen to capture the right thing at the right time? Or is this a potential place for theaters to mine for content in terms of like, hey, is it possible to draw more directors who are doing YouTube things or are doing, self-published things or things of that nature? And finding directors and interesting movie ideas from places well outside the traditional framework
I mean,
of.
the directors of Obsession are also YouTube
Yeah.
content creators, so there might be something happening there. And like full credit to A24 for like realizing this fit in with their general like momentum and movement and casting the right person in the main role because he's phenomenal. He's a good actor,
Yeah.
period. Like the fact that they got him for this movie is. I would love to have. I would love. I'm gonna have to look this up. I need to know the backstory of how they convinced him to be the guy in this movie. Because like, I don't know what the pitch is. Unless he was like already a fan of this somehow. Like
Yeah.
if he's lurking on Reddit and was following all these stories, and on the YouTube pages and following all these videos,
Yeah.
like where did the connection come from? Because he is like a far higher caliber actor than honestly should be in this movie as the main
Well,
actor.
yeah, and I think I can never pronounce it. Chiwetel Ejiofor. I think one of the things with him is he is a great secondary actor, but he hasn't been given a ton of opportunities to be the lead guy. So I think a cool, unique, original script opportunity to be a leading man on this might have been part of the reason that he was able to take it or was interested. But yeah. Yeah, it's really fascinating.
I mean, this movie, like the it is, it surprised me with just the depth of it. It's very much about psyche and emotional trauma and how we handle things, and it's not just oh, there's something scary around the corner. So yeah, I don't even know if I probably wouldn't even call it a horror movie, even though it's marketed that way, because the any horror is really like psychological. It's a lot of like you hear something but you never see it until the last 20 minutes of the movie where it goes completely off the rails. But if you're gonna see the movie, I'm not gonna give any of that away because it's just so absurd. I don't even know what to do with that, honestly, still
Yeah.
after seeing the movie. But it was a good movie, and I think it's gonna make money for a little while because I think more people are gonna be interested in going to see it after being told about it.
Well, and after opening weekend, the chatter about it has only escalated. So it would not surprise me if you see only a slight drop off between week one and week two, because I think it's the discourse around it has exploded, which I think will drive people to come out and see this who might not have otherwise considered it.
And what I think is really cool, like with Obsession and with this, both of their successes in comparison with like The Mandalorian and Grogu not being super successful, you and I and a lot of people just in the general audience have been crying out for original thoughts and original film, and that's what these movies are.
Yeah.
So hopefully their success drives more opportunities and more success
Yeah.
for different kinds of storytelling, because that's what we want to see.
It's interesting. There's like a change that's kind of happened in the world of books that this might be an indication of happening in movies. Whereas previously, if your content was strong, and in some ways that wasn't the only factor, but you could become a published author. One of the things that publishing companies want to see now is, do you already have a platform? Do you already have a market that you're selling people that you can sell? Do you have like an email list? Do you have a social media presence? Do you have something already that we know we'll be able to market to when we if we do a book for you? I wonder if you're going to end up seeing more of this stuff come in towards movies of saying, hey, do we already have an audience for this? Are we sure we have an audience for this? And allowing some more sources in of like, okay, do we know that this YouTube material or this director, has he proven he has an audience with him that's going to come to the theaters to support this content? I wonder if we'd see some more of that. All right. Well, that is the box office for this past week. Let's move on to what's opening this coming week. And what's opening this coming week? We have kind of two main releases here. We have a Scary Movie comes out this Friday. And the synopsis here is 26 years after outrunning a suspiciously familiar masked killer, Ghostface, the core four are back in the killer's crosshairs, and no horror movie IP is safe. And of course, you have the Wayans brothers in this as well, Anna Faris, Regina Hall, Dave Sheridan, all sorts of things there. So that is rated R, 1 hour, 36 minutes. And the other main release here is Masters of the Universe. The plot here is when Prince Adam was 10 years old, he crashed to Earth in a spaceship and was separated from his magical power sword, the only link to his home, Eternia. After tracking it down almost 2 decades later, Prince Adam is whisked back across space to defend his home planet against the evil forces of Skeletor. PG-13, 2 hours and 13 minutes. Stars Nicholas Galitzine, Camila Mendes, Alison Brie is in this one, Marina Baccarin, Kristen Wiig, Jared Leto, Idris Elba. So, decent cast in that one. Those are your two main releases. Also, you have Power Ballad, rated R, 1 hour and 38 minutes. And synopsis here is Rick, a past his prime wedding singer, and Danny, a fading boy band star, bond over music and late night jam sessions. When Danny turns one of Rick's songs into a hit, Rick sets out to reclaim the recognition he believes he deserves. So this is a comedy drama type thing. Paul Rudd and Nick Jonas are your main cast for this one. All right, Rob, what do you make of the three coming out this week?
So I'll definitely be seeing Scary Movie because it's ridiculous. It makes fun of horror movies, and I have liked all the previous versions, and I really like that they're targeting sinners as a main part of this movie. I'm really excited to see what they do with that.
Yeah, it should be
I've already
interesting.
seen a couple of things in the trailers that look really funny related to that. Power Ballad, I have been very interested in since I saw the first trailer for it. I love movies about music, and this is looks like a cool original story around what we have seen happen in music, in the music world before, where someone takes a piece of or a whole song from someone else and uses it as their own song. So that looks really cool to me. And I'm not sure what to make about my feelings in regards to Masters of the Universe. And I want to play the no prior research opening weekend box office guessing game on this one.
Yeah, I think so.
I'll let you go first.
So, first, my thoughts on this. I think this is too much of a deep cut 80s thing. And I don't know who's clamoring to see this. I mean, to me, there's a reason you haven't seen these characters since the 80s. And I don't see the current box office audience being like, ooh, another superhero franchise? Let's jump on board that. I do not see that happening. So I think this thing is going to tank and tank hard. I'm going 48 million.
Ooh, that would be rough. That would be rough. I'm wondering what the studio would be hoping for, like as a minimum, to like be content with how it opens. Because they're marketing this movie like the way this movie's been marketed and all over the place, like this movie, I feel like, has to make triple digits opening weekend to be successful, and I don't think it's gonna get there.
It's either.
Yeah, I'm a little more optimistic. I'm gonna say like 60.
Okay.
But I think that would not be a number they'd be super happy with.
No, I'm sure it isn't. All right. Well, that is the box office. And by the way, real quick, Backroom in week two makes more money than Masters of the Universe. Yes, no?
Based on my 60 million prediction, I would say yes.
Yeah, I'm going yes too. Okay. All right. On to our discussion. Last week, Rob and I gave each other assignments to research color usage, and we assigned each other a specific color. So Rob assigned me to do red, and I gave Rob green. And so, how we were going to tackle this, and maybe Rob, I'll let you give the premise since this was your baby for discussion.
So I was just thinking about the general idea of color usage in movies, and we've talked about how different colors can mean different things, or we just associate a certain color with a movie or a character or a title, or that this could really go like a lot of different directions. This is why I wanted to do it, because I thought that'd be a cool concept to have more of an open-ended discussion around something, instead of saying just like we're going to do this from this time period about like this genre. Like this is kind of a choose your own adventure thing, and I think it's something we could do again in the future with other colors for sure. Having done like my work on the color green, like it made me really think about, and the main reason why I did it made me really think about like what in movies, the one of the subjects that I love the most stands out to me the most related to a color. Like it's just it was fun. It was fun for me, and I hope it was fun for you.
For sure.
Just to go with that. So I will, given that preamble, I will let you start out with your thoughts on the color red. I think we can have some, I mean, with mine, I've got some built-in discussion thoughts we can go back and forth on. And we'll see what you came up with here. So.
So there's a lot of different ways to use red, and red is one where you expect it to be an emotional color. Because it's very vivid, it's very bold, it's very in your face at the use of red. But there's lots of interesting, subtle ways to use it. So kind of how I went about this is I thought of and did some research on specific instances where red is prominent and picked out ones that I was like, oh yeah, for sure. That's it. And they function on kind of different levels. So I will kind of talk through the uses of red through the examples that I'm giving. And the first one, if you've seen this, you know what I'm talking about. It's the girl in the red coat from Schindler's List. And because this film,
Funnily enough, Ryan, I want to stop for a second.
yeah.
I brought up this concept to my coworker, and that was the first thing he said.
And there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
And because this film, in addition to being an emotional gut punch and extremely disturbing and extremely moving and all sorts of things, like this is one of those moments that kind of stands out for you because most of the movie is shot in black and white. And you see almost everything in black and white. And then specifically, you see a specific girl in a red coat. And it's one child amongst thousands of children. And I think what they're trying to do here with the use of red is to kind of paraphrase the quote from Stalin, who was active at this time. One death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic. And so when people hear about the numbers of people who were killed in the Holocaust, that seems overwhelming. What the director does here is he gives you and draws your specific attention to one specific individual. So the use of red here is to boldly juxtaposition against the black and white to make it stand out. And in this case, it gives it the emotional anchor. Red is an emotional color. So it gives it the emotional anchor of drawing your attention to one specific thing. And that's one of the things that red is good for, is it draws your attention. And so this is kind of like this, it creates the emotional anchor of the film. It kind of guides Schindler's transformation and is one of the standout uses of color, especially the color red, as like the standout pop accent color. It's one of the best usage of this color around. So the idea of creating an incredible contrast and drawing your attention to something using the color red is clearly one of the ways that it works.
Another one I would it's obviously not the same emotional impact whatsoever. It's an entirely different kind of movie, but you see the same effect in the mo in the Sin City movies, because a lot of that is black and white, but then you have like parts of different colors thrown in there to draw your attention to something or distract your attention from something else that you should be paying attention to.
And I won't spend too much time on this one, but the movie Hero and some of the fight sequence. There's one fight sequence where both of the characters are in bright red dresses in a forest amongst yellow falling leaves. And if you have not seen Hero, it is one of the most visually stunning films you've ever seen. It does not get nearly enough attention that it deserves, partially because it came kind of on the heels of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon and the success that had. So it kind of felt like one of those after effect movies that, oh, we'll bring this one out because we had success with the other ones. But on its own, it stands out. It's an incredible film. And it was kind of a master class in using color as art. And you watch the scenes, you watch the fight scenes and the two characters stand in red, and just it flows. Like there's it's almost like a painting that's taking place out in the middle of this battle sequence. And it just really the use of red here creates an emotional intensity, again, because of the contrast with the yellow. But watching it, your eyes are just drawn to it. And it makes you feel like it makes you feel the passion and the flood of emotion that you get when you watch these scenes and these fight sequences. It's less about the believability and more about the emotion and the beauty of it. So using red as a way to draw contrast in terms of artwork. So we're using red in terms of art and elevating something into artwork. So this is, it's one of the most beautiful and stunning visual movies, and red is a key part of one of the main most beautiful scenes. So it really is about color. The movie and the scene is about color, and that particular element really works out well.
Nice.
My third one, and the last two are kind of in their own category because it uses a specific instance of red that really stands out and becomes one of the defining moments of the film. And it uses it as red as a visual metaphor. And the first one along those lines is the American Beauty Rose Petal Fantasy. where he sees the girl and he's imagining her in the bathtub, and her bathtub is filled with rose petals. And that visual element, the rose petals become like the symbol of his fantasy and his desire. And it makes it kind of a dreamlike state. And so then you continue to see that motif of the red rose petal coming back and back as he's entering more and more into his obsession and into more his fantasy world. So the red rose petals become the symbol of his fantasy life, and when his mind is detaching from reality on those fronts. And so if you think about that movie, American Beauty, you almost certainly think about the rose petals in the bathtub as the main visual metaphor for that
Yeah,
film.
because really, like the contrast here is that like his life is entirely bleak.
Yes.
Like in the movie, he has to have something to pine for, to yearn for, because everything around him is terrible.
And so kind of the last one here was the red pill from the Matrix. And this one is fascinating because it's only a moment of red. Like it's one of the only instances of red in those films whatsoever, because they're just not, they're much more on the blue green basis. And the one moment of red, this red pill stands out. And what's fascinating about this is the red pill symbolized an awakening. It symbolized waking up to the reality that you see. And that is fascinating because that left the realm of simply movies and has been carried on into culture, where you can have re people regularly describe red pill moments or being red pilled and basically being awakened into something. Now, sometimes those are terrible things.
Yeah, I would say this has been co-opted by some people who are spouting some pretty egregiously dumb stuff.
Yes. However, but the concept and the idea has transcended the movie itself and become a cultural phenomenon, where I can almost guarantee you there's quite a few people who've heard this or even used this term that don't really realize where it comes from. Kind of like the idea of like a sliding doors moment, which originated from the 1990s film Sliding Doors. And it's the same kind of thing with the red pill, is that it became the symbol of awakening to a deeper reality than what you've experienced, and making that choice. And so red was the striking color used in an otherwise film filled with blacks and grays and greens and blues. And there's this one little pop of red. And again, it draws your attention to symbolize that kind of choice.
I would say also, when we're thinking about the Matrix, the girl in the red dress stands out to me too.
Yes.
And that's like a very small moment in the movie, but it's like a huge part of his understanding the concept of what's going on around him.
Yes, for sure. All right,
Nice.
what you got on green?
So first of all, the first thing I thought of was how many archetypal characters are the color green? And like more than I can think of really with any other color, which is really interesting to me. I'm sure if I thought longer about it, I'd gone with a lot for other colors, but they're green, but they have different meanings behind the green, which I find to be fascinating. The first one I thought of was The Mask, Jim Carrey. With that one, I would say that green represents like mischief or insanity, even because he goes from this mild-mannered just bank employee Stanley Ipkiss to this absolute crazy sex fiend, like just off completely off the rails when he puts on this mask and turns his entire face green. I think it was a good color for them to use for that because it really pops, like it really stands out against everything else that's happening in the movie because it is so different
Yeah.
from the rest of the world around him. Another one I thought of was The Grinch. And I think you could associate the green with the Grinch with envy. Like very strong connection to envy with the Grinch because he is just so unhappy. His life is miserable. He just wants to be accepted by someone. And I one thing I like about the Grinch, the different movies and TV special and everything, there have been different takes on like where the Grinch got that feeling from in his past, in his present, but it's always there, like this relentless need to be accepted, seems to be what's really driving him behind that. Similarly, another character that's green with envy, pardon the pun, the Green Goblin in Spider-Man. Like he just wants, he just wants the recognition. He wants the world to see him for the genius he is. And he'll do anything, including terrorizing like just a parade and like harming women and children just because, his main target is obviously Spider-Man, but the broader target is the whole world so that they'll pay attention to him. So like it's it I just like was blown away by how big this is in film. And speaking of big and green, the next one would be the Hulk. And when we think of green with the Hulk, green is literally the representation of anger because it's what he becomes when he is angry. I think there's if there is a an aspect of envy associated with the Hulk, it's a little more subtle because the idea is really to create a different or better version of himself. But when you push that way, it can lead to unintended consequences, and that's where the anger comes in. And the anger can be helpful at times, but it can also be very detrimental at other times. And you would not like him when you're angry, especially if you're a bad guy. So, and the last one I thought of was Yoda. Yoda's green. But when I think about Yoda and what kind of intrigues me with him in green is the green with Yoda is like a lot more muted. And like when I think of Yoda in green, like I wisdom is just the first thing that comes to my mind. Because really he is the conscience of Star Wars. Think about it. Like he's the one that's telling people what's the best path to go down. Not necessarily always telling them why it's the best path to go down, but I think that's because the characters have to live through things and understand things themselves, and grow in that. So I just thought that was pretty bizarre, but also really cool. There's all these characters, but like green is like the thing about them, but they all represent different things.
And I mean, I immediately off the top of my head when you said that, I thought of two others that you didn't even mention, Shrek and the Wicked Witch of the West.
Oh yeah.
yeah, this
There's
is
something with that color and characters that stand out.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and then the other thing I thought of is a movie that I just watched this afternoon because I had not watched in a while. It's The Green Mile. I think The Green Mile for me is probably it's easily top 25. It's probably pushing top 10. You've seen The Green Mile?
I have. It's been a while, but yeah, I've
Yeah.
seen them off.
Like this is probably the reason why I would say it's so high is I think it's one of the best examples of how you don't need like huge special effects. You don't need tons of different settings to make a good movie. You kind of just need people who can really act and good material for them to act on. This cast is like ridiculous, ridiculous. Like Gary Sinise is in this movie and he's only in it for like 3 minutes because he's the lawyer. And you're like, oh, look, there he is. And Sam Rockwell is great as the like jerk new prisoner that comes in, like before people really knew who Sam Rockwell even was.
Yeah.
Tom Hanks is obviously the main character. Michael Clarke Duncan, the other main character. Performances, like every performance of this movie is good. I really like when a movie can combine elements of realism with elements of mystical, and this movie probably does it better than almost any other one because it's almost all just a normal story, and then Michael Clarke Duncan's character is like bringing a rat back to life, and he's healing people of their diseases. And the ending of the movie is just ridiculously powerful.
Yeah.
The scene that really stuck out to me watching this again is Tom Hanks asking Michael Clarke Duncan's character, "What do I tell God on the day of judgment that I let an innocent man die? Like, what could I possibly tell him that would make it okay?" And he said, "You could tell the good Lord you were doing me a kindness, because all of this pain that I'm taking away from people is staying in me." And he said, "It feels like there's glass in my head, and it's always pounding, and it never goes away." And then, as he's being executed, they're going to put the hood on him, and he says, "Please don't put that hood on me. Please don't put me in the dark. I was afraid of the dark." And something he had said earlier in the movie, and the fact that he comes back with that line right then, is it's a powerful moment. And I really also like, I in general like movies that do this well, where you start with a character in the future and they start to tell their story, and then they flash back and tell the story through, and then it goes back to the character at the end. Another movie I th immediately comes to mind with that technique is Amadeus with Salieri. I really like when a movie does that and does it well, because it gives you a really cool progression of how this person end up where we find them at the beginning of this, what drove them to that, and like who they become. If you haven't seen The Green Mile, I highly recommend it. It is based on a Stephen King story. But it's like the thing with Stephen King, a lot of people associate him with just horror and scary things, but he's just, that's not all he does. Like, he's written lots of things that are delve differently, like
His non-horror stuff, I honestly think it's better than his
like
horror stuff.
11, 22, 63,
Shawshank
and those,
Redemption.
among others, are all really good. So that's my thoughts on The Color Green.
Nice. I like it. Very good. Good. And we had some interesting different takes on some of our two colors, so I like that. All right. We'll close out with movies we've watched over the last week. Rob, what'd you watch?
So I was told to talk about two movies I saw that were not in the last week because I didn't talk about them previously, and so just listens to the podcast wants to hear my thoughts on them. So the first one was Hokum, starring Adam Scott, which came out last month, about a witch. And Adam Scott is at this hotel and finds out that this witch is controlling things and taking people, and that people don't know what's happening with all of it. He does a really good job playing a jerk. The movie in general was okay. Like, I didn't think it was great. I think I have it in my like lower third of the movies I've seen so far this year. If you're into scary movies, it's worth watching, but it's not phenomenal by any stretch. The other one that I was asked to talk about was Mortal Kombat, which I saw. Mortal Kombat 2. Very funny movie. Very inappropriately funny movie. But not the best movie either. But like, it does have some good lines. Like the one character, he says, "I of course I want to save the Earth. I love everything about the Earth. I love Jack and Coke. I love Coke." Like, he's like listing all these things that he really loves about the planet Earth. This was an enjoyable movie. I would say it was an enjoyable experience. But it's definitely not in any way, kids, like, don't take your kids to this movie. Don't let your kids watch this movie. And then as far as this week, I saw Backrooms. I talked about that already in the box office review. Very original, very cool, a lot of sleight of hand. Like, did you see something? on the screen or did not see something? Did you hear something? Did you not hear something? And some really cool exploration into just inner turmoil and how we address things when things don't go the way we want. And then I also saw Pressure, about the lead up to D-Day. Brendan Fraser is Dwight Eisenhower. I would say I've heard a few people review this, and I would agree with them that probably the presentation of Dwight Eisenhower by Brendan Fraser might be the weakest part of the movie, but I don't think he was bad. I just think, one, he doesn't look super like him, and two, like, it was really hard for me not to see Brendan Fraser. And the other part, through no fault, was Andrew Scott, the person who plays the British meteorologist who has played Moriarty in the Sherlock movies, absolutely steals the movie. He is. My personal prediction is he will be nominated for Best Supporting Actor for this movie, and I will go further and say he will probably be one of the two favorites to win at the award. His performance is like it's the movie. And this was a story that I didn't really know a lot about. Like the actual date of D-Day was historically pushed back a day. Because if they had gone the day that they had originally planned it, they would have been washed out to sea. They say there's a moment in the movie where they say, what's the most we can tolerate as far as waves go? And the person in charge of the Navy says 4 to 6 feet. And Andrew Scott's character, the meteorologist, says, I'm predicting 8 to 10 feet. So if they had actually gone through with that in that scenario, it probably would have failed. And if that invasion had failed, we would be living in a very different world. And that is one of the reasons, that is the reason why it is such a hallowed date and such a respected and recognized date, because it changed the entire course of human history. And so to see some of the background of that was incredibly fascinating for me. I will never be comfortable watching, and there is one in this movie, watching scenes of the actual invasion where, I mean, obviously Saving Private Ryan did this the best and the most intense, but seeing the gangplank come down the ship and seeing soldiers get machine gunned down before they even step off it, like I do not have it in me to be a person on one of those boats and still go forward if I saw that happen in front of me.
Crazy.
So if you can watch that and not have respect for people who have come before you and have served your country and who are serving your country currently, I don't really know what to tell you, because it is harrowing what they went through.
For sure. For
But
sure.
I would recommend watching Pressure. I thought it was a very good movie. It is my Backrooms and Pressure are my number three and number four movies of the year so far.
Okay.
So take that for what it's worth. And I also, before Pressure, I saw trailers for a new trailer for The Odyssey and a new trailer for Dune Part 3. And
Nice.
I'm like over the moon for both those movies. I think they're going to end up being one and two to me in some order at the end of the year. So I can't wait.
I haven't gotten a chance to get to theaters this week, but I'm doing something that I've wanted to do for a while and just haven't gotten around to doing, is that I am watching in order The Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, and The King's Speech. All three movies that tackle pretty much the exact same time frame, but from an entirely different angle, from an entirely different person's perspective. And of course, The Darkest Hour focuses on Winston Churchill. And I love it. It's so good. Oh, man. Gary Oldman, man. He knocked it out of the park with that role. Incredible. Really good stuff. And there was Winston Churchill is a phenomenal figure. And then the next, I'm in the middle of Dunkirk right now. And of course, it is by far my least watched Christopher Nolan movie. But what he does with it is still incredible because he's Christopher Nolan. And then I'm going to finish it off with The King's Speech this coming week, if I can ever get it. Like it's in that dead, we'll have to talk about this, the dead zone of streaming, which is movies about 15 years old. The dead zone of streaming that never on there. And I keep trying to get it on the Hoopla app because I can check it out from the library on the Hoopla app. And every single time it's like, your number of libraries, number of borrows has been exceeded for the day. I'm like, it's 10 in the morning. How many people are borrowing things today? So and literally I got on there last night at like 12:05. It's like, we can't recognize your library servers. So I don't know who I'm calling out, if I'm calling out the Hoopla app, if I'm calling out the Lancaster Library for not having enough borrows to handle its viewers.
Might be time to make a visit to a library physical location and grab a physical disk, right?
I know I have not had the opportunity for that. All right. Well, that is all the show we have for you. Thank you everyone for tuning into Film for Fans. Like, subscribe, tell your friends. Until next time, enjoy the movies.